We're getting a bit Joe Rogan there, aren't we? Yeah.
Hello, and welcome back to the fourth official episode of the Global Guessing Weekly podcast. I'm Andrew, and Clay's here as well, and we're joined by a very special guest, somebody that we actually met through our Global Guessing work. We have Ross here. Ross not only has, you know, a lot of relevant degrees, you know, relevant to geopolitics, but he also has the brand AR Global Security, which focuses on the current and future state of geopolitics and, you know, statehood, cybersecurity, and all that good stuff. We're going to get into a lot of it in this podcast. So, Ross, thank you so much for joining us and welcome.
Hi, you're all right.
So let's talk about AR Global Security, how you got started with it, and sort of your mainstream series on that this week in geopolitics.
I think I told you guys before about how I started, and like, I can't remember exactly what I said, but if you want to go straight to the basics, basically I left university, my undergraduate degree, in 2015, started applying for a few jobs quite unsuccessfully. And then this one company who I applied to, who weren't sort of like a big chain, if I can describe it that way, but they weren't small either. They just rejected me. So I thought, why not just make a company that's sort of similar to them and just grow to the point where I outcompete them? That was the pure logic behind it at the time. It was just sort of a, I wouldn't describe it as vengeance, but that's what motivates you. Sometimes you got to do it.
And it seems to be going pretty well, right? You've passed 100,000 followers on TikTok. You're getting up to 10K on your YouTube channel. I mean, things are going pretty well. How's that sort of success? How have you been taking it? And just what's that sort of experience been like, seeing that sort of explosive growth this quickly?
To be really honest with you, with the lockdown, it's actually sort of weird because it's just numbers on a screen. Like no one sort of, I haven't seen any of my friends or anything. I've been on a walk with a couple of them and they said, oh wow, you've got 100,000 TikTok followers now. And it's weird. Like we see your videos on our For You page and stuff. So that was when it sort of, the first time that it sort of hit home was then. But at the moment, without being able to go outside and see anyone, it's kind of like, it's not really hit me, the scope of it yet. Like 8,000, I think I'm nearly at 8,000 subscribers on YouTube now. It's not mega, but it's not nothing.
It's not nothing.
So it's kind of, yeah, I don't know how to describe it really, to be honest with you. I'm just grateful for people actually wanting to listen to what I've got to say. And then obviously I try and keep things focused on the actual stuff I'm talking about. Like a lot of people, I find especially, this is why I don't watch US news at all. I mean, I won't watch any US news because sometimes they make it a bit too personal, whereas I try and focus on the matter at hand and keeping it impartial. That's also another reason why I started the channel, is just the lack of impartial media out there. Like you read, I did a lot of stuff. Obviously, I studied Russia for a year. So I studied Russian foreign policy, and a lot of the time they're recommending like Radio Free Europe, or have you ever heard of that before?
No, what's that?
I've heard of Radio Free
Europe. Radio Free Europe was I can't say it was set up by the CIA because I can't exactly remember that, but I think it was set up by an American.
It's like US funded, I think.
Yeah. So that was basically to get news to people in like the USSR, I think, into the communist bloc. And we get recommended a lot of that for my course, and it's just it does the job, but it's quite biased towards Russia, if you get what I mean. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously what the Russians do isn't perfect, what the US doesn't perfect, what the UK isn't perfect, but I just think it's sometimes you need to keep it just impartial and let people see let people decide for themselves. Like, give them the facts. Don't withhold any facts. I will say things that are not good for the UK, not good for the US, not good for Russia. So, I mean, that's why I guess, well, sometimes my videos don't do so well on TikTok. They won't do so well on YouTube because It's when you're impartial, everyone hates you.
Because you're not taking their side, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But exactly. I have noticed that, at least as of right now, like, your comment sections tend to be at least pretty positive relative to the larger internet conversation that happens around geopolitics. And I think probably that impartiality is really helping you out there, because...
Yeah, I mean, I don't moderate the comment section per se. I mean, if someone puts something quite profane on there, or outright just says something wrong, or like the sky's green or whatever, I will delete it, because I don't, that's just not, it's not what I want for people that are watching my channel. So,
right. Right. Yeah. As Clay mentioned, one of your most successful series is This Week in Geopolitics.
Yeah.
We were wondering, you know, are there some stories this week or in the past couple of weeks that you've been following within the world of geopolitics? You know, obviously things in Myanmar picked up and you made a video about that. Yeah, are there sort of stories that you're keeping an eye on?
Yeah, try and keep me on topic, because I will go off topic. But yeah, I'll talk about This Week in Geopolitics. The biggest one, I mean, Myanmar, I haven't really focused on as much, because it's been more protests and sort of domestic political stuff at the moment, whereas I try and keep things between countries, if you get what I mean, more international relations,
yeah,
in that sort of sense. But the big one for me this week was did you see the Chinese-Russian lunar base news?
Yeah.
I thought that was quite interesting, actually.
Do you want to just give some context for that for the viewers if they haven't sort of read that story yet?
I mean, well, I to be honest with you, I was reading about it before I came on this, and trying to. So I was thinking about trying to make a video, maybe a TikTok video on that.
Okay, great.
So they basically, I think they've just laid the plan, the foundations, the plans to put a moon. I think they said in orbit or on the surface of the moon, looking more likely on the surface of the moon.
Yeah.
There's not really much detail on it at the moment, so I think it'll be quite interesting. But
that's fascinating. I'm trying to
link this to your sort of forecasting, because the reason why it was interesting for me is because obviously China and Russia, the relationship between those two countries, to build a lunar base together is quite a big thing.
Massive commitment.
Yeah, it's kind of, and the relationship between China and Russia, in my view, it isn't a sustainable one. It's not, like, a lot of people say, oh, China and Russia are like this, are kind of allied, and whereas, I don't know, I view it as more, along with a lot of other analysts, a lot of other people, as more of an, I think the words were an axis of convenience, like they only cooperate because they have a common enemy. They don't.
Yeah, because, I mean, China and Russia themselves have their own disputes, especially like inside into Asia around like Mongolia. There's a lot of disputes there.
Yeah, Central Asia is a big competition, is a big field of competition for them, especially like Kyrgyzstan. I think China claims 2/3 of Kyrgyzstan of its territory. Like, I don't know. And Russia kind of views that post-Soviet space as its own backyard. Mm-hmm. And obviously China's building the Belt and Road through there. I don't know. And then the biggest one for me between Russia and China is Siberia. It's just like, so a lot of people don't really talk about it, but so I did an essay on it for when I was at King's, when I was studying Russia, and Siberia is a big point of contention. Like, obviously Russia took a lot of land from China back in the day, and a lot of that land now has resources, and as the climate warms, Siberia is going to become habitable, and China's population seems to have exploded. So there's a sort of, if you go on Google Earth and look at the border between Russia and China in sort of Manchuria, you can see the difference straight away. Like, the Chinese side of the border, the cities are sort of everywhere. There's farm, the land's used for farm. You go on the Russian side, there's so little in the way of farmland and urban areas. There's just a stark difference. And I don't know, this is what I was going to say, I'll link it to you guys as forecasting. I'm geographically deterministic. Like, that surely there's some point of contention there. Like, if something happens in the future, I'm not saying tomorrow, but maybe in the next sort of 50 years, like, things can change in a big way. Like, if China just suddenly decides that's ours again, or I'm sort of throwing things out here, but yeah. Quite, and then obviously to build a lunar base is a big commitment. So I don't know. It was just an interesting one for me. Obviously the stories are going to develop a bit more. And then obviously last week we had the Silk Road announcement, like the Polar Silk Road announcement.
I was going to bring that one. I thought that one was really interesting with China having the Arctic base. And what did you, so for those of you who don't know, in Ross's last week, This Week in Geopolitics, he talked about China wanting to have an Arctic base, investing in there, and particularly for trade routes, because as the ice caps continue to melt, I believe, shipping up around the Arctic will be, did you say it was 30-something% faster than going through the Suez Canal?
So it's 2/3 of the time going. Yeah, I think 30% would fit. So 2/3 of the time to go through this. So if you went through the Suez Canal, 66% of the time. My maths isn't great, but yeah, it's a third shorter is basically what I'm trying to say.
And that has massive implications, right? Especially for China, that's such an export-heavy country.
Absolutely.
Do you know what sort of other geopolitics of the Arctic is? This is an area that I know very little about.
I mean, that's what I wanted to I wanted to write my undergraduate dissertation and my master's dissertation both on the Arctic, actually. So, but yeah, basically, I think by 2050, I'm sort of throwing out a rough ballpark guess there. That's when the Arctic may be ice-free for sort of large parts of the year. So obviously you have the Northwest Passage, which goes through Canada. There's sort of like, you can get through there. And there's obviously, I don't know if you know this, but there's a dispute between sort of Canada and the wider world, mainly the US, about whether the Northwest Passage is an international waterway for use by everybody, or whether it's a domestic waterway within Canada. And so that Canada has sort of discretion over who passes through that as well. That's really interesting. Might have to do a video on that. You never know.
Ideas coming up.
That's the way I write. I just write things down when I sort of go through different topics, and then I just build on top of it. But yeah, you got the Northeast Passage as well, which is going to be the big one, because Russia is looking to develop that area sort of in the high north. I'm not quite sure if that's the correct term as well, but that's the sort of term they use for Scandinavia and places like that. But yeah, that sort of area is starting to become increasingly important as we sort of go forward into the 21st century. I would say we basically at King's, we had a massive war sort of crisis simulation, they called it. So we did the Arctic for that simulation, and it was quite interesting because I had, obviously studying geopolitics, I had to make the map for it. So I had to map every single military base in the Arctic, pretty much. And the Russian ones, there's big moves on the part of Russia in terms of the military going in there. The US/NATO just reopened a base in Iceland as well a few years ago. So obviously it's starting to build up there as well. And China coming to town as well will be even more interesting.
Do you think, I'm pretty sure that in the Arctic there's a really large supply of like undiscovered oil and like other natural resources. Do you think that's part of the sort of land grab, so to speak, that's going on right now?
Huge part of it. I completely forgot about it. But yeah, on top of that, you got huge oil reserves up there as well. Most of them in the Russian exclusive economic zone. Mm-hmm. So I think that it'll be a pretty straightforward game actually in the Arctic, sort of delineating the boundaries of the exclusive economic zones. And obviously, well, I think that, I don't know how much you know about sort of maritime law and international law.
Like the distance from shore out into the water that you have sort of sovereign reign over.
Yeah. So you get so each country gets 12 miles of territorial waters, which are sort of their waters. I mean, I think ships can pass in it if it's sort of a reasonable sort of thing. But then you also get 200 nautical mile exclusive economic zone, which you have the rights to exploit the resources in there. And then you get on top of that, you can get, you can, if you prove that your continental shelf extends further out, you can also claim that as well. I think that's the only point of contention in the Arctic that I can think of. Other than that, it's sort of looking towards more of a cooperative environment. I mean, a lot of people would beg to differ, but from what I've read, that's the sort of way it seems to be going. I mean, Russia, Norway, Iceland, Denmark with Greenland, Canada, the US. Not entirely. Some people like to sort of make out there's going to be a big point of contention, but I think those countries, there's a low likelihood of them ever going into outright war over it, basically, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
then does that make it valuable for the US to purchase Greenland? Was Trump smart all along thinking about the trading routes?
That was one thing I had to say I thought was a smart move on the part of Trump. A lot of people seem to sort of say how stupid it was, but I just thought, well, you get that all that exclusive economic zone, the Arctic, all that coastline on the Arctic. I mean, the US has tried to buy Greenland before, so it's not really new. But yeah, it was quite interesting.
Is it Denmark that currently has like quasi control over Greenland? I'm watching a foreign show about, I think it's Denmark, and there's a whole episode about Greenland. So that's really my basis of knowledge here, which is not the strongest.
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay, that's so.
It's a weird one.
Fully autonomous right now.
They are pretty much that. They're pretty much autonomous. I mean, I think there is some debate about becoming independent, but there's not much. I think they're too economically reliant on Denmark, but there was some weird stuff about Greenland and fishing rights between the EU member states and stuff as well. It's all sort of linked, but yeah, I think they're sort of very autonomous.
EU member states really care about fishing rights, huh?
Yeah, it's big deal.
Big deal.
Yeah. I mean, we discovered Portugal, and they definitely care about their fishing rights. They're right on the border, so.
Yeah, exactly. And they've got lots of islands.
And the UK also cares about their fishing rights. That was their
absolutely.
That was their big victory in Brexit, was that they got to keep all their fish, right? Or 66%
of
their fish.
Yeah. I don't know the exact details on the fishing, but the Brexiteers don't seem happy about it. And then, I don't really know. I don't know how to explain it. You asked me about the exclusive economic zones. Have you ever heard of ROCL before?
I haven't.
Nope.
Can you spell it?
ROCKALL. I'm only sort of joking with you. It's like this weird little rock in the middle of the Atlantic that we claimed in I think it was the 80s or the 70s to extend our fishing rights, and it was a big hoo-ha over it between sort of us, I think Ireland and Iceland maybe.
That's
quite funny. That was a focus of our lectures when I was studying geopolitics. So
I think these zones are going to become a lot more mainstream as you see more activity in the South China Sea and, you know, in the Mediterranean with Cyprus and Greece and Turkey and what's going on there. And, you know, Portugal has two islands that they have autonomous control over that they've really used to extend their EEZ out even further. So I think it's only going to become more common, you know, as territory around the world sort of tightens up. There's a so everybody needs to leverage.
You said about talking about the future of statehood and stuff. Well, that's just, that is the fact that that countries are sort of jostling over the sea now is just this sort of demonstrative of the fact that there's not really any land left. There's no land anywhere on the world that's not, it sounds fairly obvious, but there's not the space that we have is starting to be used more and more for different things. And the countries are turning to the sea because you just look at sea farming as a technology that will come in the future. Oil, you know what I mean? Resources.
Yeah. And actually, you just mentioned that future of statehood video. And actually, we'd like to talk about that a little bit because that is the first episode in your ARGS Classic series. I thought it was me and Andrew have both watched the video and we're both big fans of it. It was really interesting. I believe you derived it from your master's thesis.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if you could first just sort of give a sort of brief summary of the argument that you make in that video. I also have on my left, which I'll show the viewers when we get to it, the sort of vertical horizontal layout diagram as well.
So that was my framework that I came up with so I did an essay on why states no longer need territory. And I did my dissertation on how states can have a mix of territory I called it a hybrid state. So you'd have sort of ethnic minorities in different countries being able to be direct citizens of the country, of their sort of home state. It's quite hard I don't know where to start from really. But yeah, the reason why I made that series is because A lot of people think geopolitics is sort of the relationship between different states, and that does come into it. But for my course, I went into it thinking, oh, I'm going to be learning about how Russia and the US interact and how certain things, but geopolitics is more focused on boundaries and the use of space and borders and all of that stuff. And I was so glad that I did that course, because it opened the way for this channel. I learned about, obviously I can talk about exclusive economic zones, and the classic series was to sort of bring it back to that and look at the sort of the founding thought of geopolitics. So that video, I don't know, you guys should probably ask me questions.
Yeah, so
nowhere to start. I'm probably talking quite a lot as well. So
I'll start off with my attempt at summarizing it, and then we can have a discussion. So that recently that there have been a few sort of trends that have happening. There's the rise of these really powerful multinational corporations that are sort of approaching governance in many ways. You have the rise of the internet and cyberspace, which is sort of having this time-space compression, which is the idea that sort of like geographic distance matters less because people and capital can travel across the globe either instantly if it's capital or people within 24 hours. And you say that that could possibly lead to this idea of deterritorialization. States are defined as having a permanent population, a government, a capacity to enter relations with other states, and a defined territory. And it's your argument that because of these effects, that sort of fourth pillar is going to go away for at least some semblance of states. So that you end up with this creation, and I'm showing the diagram for your video, where you have the sort of traditional territorial states where people live as being the horizontal states, but that they can also be citizens in these sort of extraterritorial vertical states. And what I thought was really interesting about this idea that you mentioned is that having these vertical states leads to sort of competition for taxpayers, right? It's going to sort of have more efficiency in governance because people can choose where they are, their sort of vertical citizen, and they're going to go wherever is the most sort of efficient for them.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of happening already. Sorry to interrupt. When you think about it, you've got, say, Barbados and Georgia. Two countries that, not the US state, by the way, but there's two different countries that have opened up working visas for people. And people, personally, if my channel ever gets to the point where I can sort of work from anywhere, where I have that income, then I might maybe move to somewhere like that, because it's a nice place to, well, they've got the better weather, first off, but it's just competing for people, aren't they? You can, there's a lot of, as I say, the physical distance is starting to become irrelevant. So people can work from anywhere. Sorry, I'm just carry on.
And then you focus on this sort of the main example being Estonia, which I knew a little bit about Estonia before this video, but you give a lot of really interesting details. So for those of you who don't know, Estonia, after it got its independence from the Soviet Union, realized, you know, we can't sort of rebuild this public infrastructure that sort of we can physically provide all our goods and services, so let's try to digitize it. And it's something like 99% of Estonian government services can be online, 99% of Estonians have a digital sort of ID and presence. Something like 40-something percent of Estonians voted digitally in the most recent election. And so you sort of present this as the example of not a fully deterritorialized state, because Estonia, you know, you can still travel to Estonia physically, but that there's a large subset of Estonians through e-residency that live in Estonia and access Estonian sort of services, but don't live in Estonia. And I was just wondering of sort of a few things. Like, we just talked about countries trying to go into the sea and trying to sort of create more territory. And I'm wondering sort of how deterritorialization sort of interacts with sort of extraterritorialization. I don't know. There's not a word for it, but you know what I'm saying, right? Like, you have these sort of two aspects. And then also, you know, there's some people that are saying that we've sort of like reached the apex of globalization, at least in the short term, and sort of how that might have an effect on this idea.
I mean, I need to make a follow-up to that video. There's a few things I missed, and I am going to do a video called The Geopolitics of Cyberspace, which will go into sort of greater detail in how, what I meant by a lot of things in that video. My favorite sort of, I mean, how do I explain it? Sort of the classically geopolitical thing, why it's classic is classics is because it is about, I don't know how to explain it. I'm sorry, but yeah, we sort of read about a lot of thinkers back in the day. So I don't know, let's check out a few names. But you had Ratzel, what's his name? Mackinder, people like that, sort of came up with theories about the relationship between people and states and territory and organic theory. And but I think we need to do that in the modern day, like the base of our society has just completely changed. I don't think a lot of people realize like how big of a thing cyberspace is. And in that video, I'll try and link it back to the video, but cyberspace is becoming a space in itself. In my view, like I mean, I'm not sure how old you guys are. Actually, I like to think you're the same age as me.
I'm 24.
Yeah, same as me. Yeah, so. But younger. You guys look older than me. not in a bad way though, in a mature way. But you know what I mean. But yeah, it's a lot of people don't realize just how, like the internet is my life at the moment, effectively because of lockdown. Everything I do is, and I interact more with people over the internet than I do in physical, in real life. And obviously that has implications for things. And
just to jump in, like I think our generation is one where our sort of ties are, yes, both towards like, I am an American, you are British, but
yeah,
also the sort of internet communities that you're a part of, right? When I was in high school, I would say a larger part of my identity than being American was being in the Call of Duty internet space, and that for me was the dominant factor. If you were to say like, where do your allegiance lies, I mean, it probably went there first. I started in Black Ops 1, although Modern Warfare 2, good game.
I
started off as a quick scoping sniper and quickly realized not for me.
You're probably better than me, to be fair. But you're 100% right. That brings identity into it as well, because like you say, I probably identify more with people like myself, you guys on the internet. Like I probably have more in common with you guys than I have with a lot of people in the UK. And obviously the video sort of talks about how that, say we were to form a state, us three, we wouldn't have any territory. We could have a government. Andrew could be our, I don't want to say anything too bad for the stream, but our leader. And then Clay, you could be you and I could be citizens. Like, that's also in the video, it doesn't explain. I focus a lot on corporations, but I should have also probably mentioned how people could just get together and make their own state. What's to stop people?
And provide their own services, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, even 100%. Had that kind of, in a really small sense during the COVID thing, with people providing their own sort of education with those sort of learning pod bubbles. And I know that's sort of very disproportionately a very privileged side that created their own state.
Yeah.
But if we're looking at who generally creates their own states historically, I mean, the Bolshevik Revolution is its own thing, even though there were a lot of elites, but it tends to be those people that create the states in the first place anyway. Yeah. It's such an interesting idea, this idea of sort of having these two citizenships, because, you know, Facebook and Twitter do provide services to people that government doesn't. And so in some way, you sort of are a citizen of the Twitter universe in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Google, all of my videos are written on Google. I get paid by Google for AdSense, for my videos. I use Google Maps every day. I mean, Google, that's sort of something I didn't mention, but which I certainly mentioned in my dissertation, was I interact with Google more than I interact with the British government on a day-to-day basis. It's just, it is the way it is. And I think the state system needs to reflect that in some ways. There's like you say, Vladimir Putin, this was in this week in geopolitics as well. a few weeks ago said that many of the US social media giants are now competing with states. And I have to say, I agree. It's just Facebook, like the Arab Spring, for example, Facebook was instrumental in that. And it's just a very powerful tool.
Do you think that any of sort of this deterritorialization that we're talking about comes from, you know, the fact that in a lot of regions around the world, you know, these states aren't natural occurrences. They're very much sort of artificially formed. And so in that way, you know, it makes sense that they might be sort of crumbling because they weren't founded on, you know, something that was too solid.
Yeah, that actually brings two things to mind. So obviously my latest video will be on Mozambique, and Mozambique had its borders drawn, I assume, I don't actually know that much, by the British and the Portuguese. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the insurgency in Cabo Delgado in northern Mozambique is between, I don't know if it's, I can say it on YouTube, I don't want to go, it's between two religious groups.
Sure.
And obviously the border was drawn through those two groups. And I don't know what the situation is like between Tanzania and Mozambique, but some of the people in Cabo Delgado have more affinity with the sort of, I think it's the Swahili culture, that sort, and the Sufi brand of Islam that goes down the east coast of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, I don't know where I'm going with this, but yeah, like you said, the borders are drawn. I can't remember the other thing I was going to say now, but yeah, obviously. Oh, that was it. I think if statehood is deterritorialized, like I said in the video, it could help people that live in regimes where their citizenship is worth nothing. Like some, mm-hmm. like they have that list of passports every year that have the most powerful passports in the world. And obviously, as British and American people, we probably don't appreciate just how many countries we can go to with our passport. Like a lot of places you can't go to certain countries. Whereas if you had let's just say, for example, probably get a lot of stick for this, as I did in my videos, Amazon. You had an Amazon passport. And Amazon, you where could you go with that? If Amazon's in so many countries in the world, like if it was a government, it would probably have good relations with many countries, I assume.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe not with a lot of people, but with many countries. So, it's like people who live in those sort of regimes, they could. So North Koreans, for example, they could get a passport for a different country that doesn't have any territory, and they could use that to go. That citizenship for whatever ends, I guess, are best.
Another question about before we get to that, it's about the hybrid warfare video, but
yeah,
one thing that you had mentioned in the future of statehood was the sort of rise of multinational companies, and I just sort of wanted, you said that they were sort of rising and becoming really powerful, and I was just wondering, like, how is their power different than, say, like, all of the major sort of colonial companies back in the 1800s, which sort of were like the drivers behind a lot of colonialization projects, whether it's the East India Trading Company, that American Banana Company that everyone,
yeah.
The United Fruit Company, that, there we go. Like sort of how does the power of sort of Google and Facebook and Amazon sort of compare to those countries, right? Because historically companies have always played this sort of large role in geopolitics.
Interesting you bring up hybrid warfare as well. Obviously warfare isn't necessarily people marching at each other from trenches, or sort of even sort of, I think it's third or fourth generation warfare, where I think fourth generation warfare is hybrid warfare. The third generation will probably be, I mean, I haven't done that much research into it.
Guerrilla, maybe?
Yeah, sort of maybe World War II. But fifth generation warfare is basically not having to lift a finger in terms of kinetic ability. So it's overthrowing governments using cyber and political avenues of warfare and link it back to companies, is where I'm trying to get to. What's to stop it? Like you say, Facebook and Google, they have so much power. What's to stop them? Well, like I say, that the Arab Spring. What's to stop them overthrowing governments with their political their raw political power that they have. They can basically like influence people's opinions, and then in the
and answer to no one as well.
Yeah, exactly. Seemingly. And like I said in the video, they could use private military companies. Like the growth of private military companies has been huge in the past sort of 20 years. And if governments can hire them, well, I assume private companies do already hire them. And
that's a scary thought.
Yeah. What is to stop a Facebook or Google hiring a private military company? I mean, I don't know if we get a stick for this from YouTube.
No, it's an interesting question.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times private military companies are used, you know, so states can sort of shirk responsibility, you know, for certain things that might be deemed inappropriate for a state to carry out, but maybe more okay for, you know, people like Blackwater to carry out. So that's a very scary thought.
Yeah. It all comes back to this sort of what I said in that video of the future of statehood video is the fluidity of everything. As technology advances, everything becomes more agile and more fluid, and it becomes more
harder to control.
Yeah, harder to control. Like so you have blockchain at the moment, actually. You guys should get on there as well. Have you ever heard of Odyssey before?
Is it a trading platform?
No, it's a video hosting site. It's called Odyssey. I mean, if I could, I would like to move. Like I would happily focus on Odyssey because it's cryptocurrency based. Everything on that website is on blockchain, so it can't be deleted from the internet by people that might want to, I don't know. And you also get paid in cryptocurrency for your video. So if someone watches your video from a signed in account, you can get like sort of 20p a view, 20p. I don't know what that is in cents, but it's a good return.
20p a view? That's a really great return. Wow.
Yeah. That's what I think. I think that's what I said on mine. I don't want to, don't quote me on it, but
yeah. No, that's
quote Ross. No.
It's a really cool website, and well, I can't remember where we've gone from this now, but yeah, it's just everything. Yeah. The fluidity and the blockchain technology as well will be huge. Everything's just sort of, this is where I was trying to go with it. Warfare is sort of, it's separating but mixing at the same time, like political warfare. That's another focus of my channel, is I try and break everything down into cyber, kinetic, and political warfare, which are the sort of the three main aspects of hybrid warfare. And everything's hybrid now. That my small wars lecturer said, oh, every war's hybrid and always has been, but now
it's becoming increasingly hybrid, right? Like kinetic used to take the vast majority of it, and now the other aspects are sort of more becoming equal in it.
The physical force aspect is decreasing big time. So
just going back quickly to, you know, we were talking about wars and sort of the future of wars and what it might look like, this hybrid warfare model. Do you see sort of conflicts picking up in frequency over the next like 10 to 15 years? Do you see them, you know, like a lot more sort of smaller conflicts, civil conflicts, or will there be, you know, an impending, you know, big conflict on the horizon? Do you have thoughts about that?
I just want to say, I'm not an expert on these things before people sort of, you know what I mean? I'm not I have a master's degree, but I don't have any credentials to my name. Geopolitics for me is just sort of a passion. I have a day job as well. I'll be walking around the streets for my day job and I'll be thinking about geopolitics.
Yeah, so, fascinating stuff.
That's sort of where I get my, not expertise, but sort of knowledge. Knowledge is probably the right word for me. Just to get that out of the way before. But yeah, obviously, so what was the question? Bigger, more frequent conflicts in sort of hybrid fashion?
Yeah. Do you see like more conflicts happening on a smaller scale, or, you know, fewer, but they're larger conflicts, or, just trends in general?
Well, I actually couldn't tell you. I mean, obviously the world is becoming more multipolar. Sort of a cliche thing to say nowadays, because everyone that does international relations or geopolitics says that. But it is trending that way. But obviously the US is still out on top. But yeah, no, in terms of smaller conflicts, I don't know, perhaps.
I'm just thinking, I feel like hybrid warfare sort of levels the playing field, so to speak, right? Like there are some countries that maybe didn't have the military force to be able to, survive a conflict or initiate conflict with another state. But now that you're able to, you know, damage another country through cyberspace or other means, it feels like, you know, the opportunity for conflict is now rising.
You've brought an example to mind straight away there. You've jogged my memory, but look at the United Arab Emirates. Have you watched my video on the United Arab Emirates? Sort of plug my own channel a bit here, but
I haven't seen that one yet. What's it about?
It's quite an old, it's a fairly old one. It's not great quality, but the United Arab Emirates is starting to make big moves, like in the Red Sea area, the Gulf of Aden, Yemen. It's not publicized really at all, but trying to link this
in the Red Sea, right?
Sorry,
it's this video. That's, right here?
Yeah. So obviously, everything I talk about links in a certain way. If you know what I mean, that's what I was saying about everything merging into one. The right. United Arab Emirates is hiring private military companies and sending them to Yemen. Well, I can't. It's not in the official capacity, if you get what I mean. I don't want to outright say it on here for misinformation, but
allegedly,
yeah. Many
people are saying,
yeah, and they're using hybrid strategies in those countries, like they're gaining political influence by buying up ports. I think Dubai Ports World is looking at Eritrea quite a lot. I think it's Assab and Massawa. My pronunciation is terrible. Djibouti, they just got kicked out of Djibouti a couple of years ago, I think. The Djiboutians sold their port concession to the Chinese, I think.
I think that's the only Chinese military base in Djibouti.
Yeah. Funnily enough, the I think it's quite close to the base, like the port concession that I think it's Dorola, it's called. It's Berbera in Somaliland or Somalia, whichever you want to choose. Mm-hmm. Puntland as well. Have you heard of Puntland before?
I haven't.
Puntland?
Puntland.
Puntland, no.
Puntland. So basically, I can't remember what city it is, but the UAE has sort of gone against actually, Dubai Ports World is banned in Somalia, yet they operate, and the United Arab Emirates has relations with Puntland, which is an autonomous region of Somalia, and Somaliland, which is a breakaway separatist region of Somalia. So that sort of links in with the hybrid sense. They're garnering political influence in those countries and using the private military companies to fulfill the kinetic aspect that they might not be able to fulfill themselves. I'm not sure what the population is of the UAE, but obviously they don't have a military, as strong military capability of their own. So they use other people. Cyber, I don't know their capacity, but it's interesting. Like, it's just... as I say, everything's merging into one, and that's how they're making their sort of geostrategic moves. I mean, a lot of people use the word geostrategy, but I think it sounds cool, so I use it quite a lot.
It's a great word.
Yeah. Do you think that states are sort of getting... It seems like states aren't prepared for hybrid warfare, especially big states like the United States that have sort of just been able to coast, usually with posture and threats in cyberspace. It seems like they're pretty vulnerable to hybrid attacks, whether it's like directly to infrastructure online, to disinformation,
elections, cough,
potentially elections. There's no evidence that would work. I'm thinking a lot of Americans have money tied up in Bitcoin. We know that China has a lot of the mining power on Bitcoin. Who's to say that if China were to engage in hybrid warfare, they wouldn't try to do a 50%+ attack on Bitcoin and cause havoc in that way? So, you know, like, are there states that you think are getting better prepared for it? Do you think a smaller country like the UK is better positioned to sort of defend themselves in hybrid warfare?
So the UK and the US, I mean, as I say, I'm not an expert, but it just seems like we're a bit slow at the moment. Like, we're not...
Except for vaccines.
Yeah, we're pretty good at that. We can give ourselves that, to be fair. We're just a bit... We're sort of a bit cumbersome in that regard. I mean, I think the UK has... The UK is starting to move towards... I'm not sure about the US, but I think we were going to have an army without tanks at one point, or there was some sort of news story about us not having any tanks anymore, because what use are tanks? You just get a drone to blow them up. Like, and you look at Nagorno-Karabakh, Turkey won that war through giving the Azerbaijanis drones. It's just the technological side of it. But yeah, what was the question again? The states are different states.
Like which states, if any, are sort of positioning themselves better to handle it.
Russia, 100%. Russia has quite, obviously, with this collapse of the Soviet Union, I think their military just fell apart and was. I remember learning about the Chechen War and people, the soldiers selling their weapons because they were so poor, and they were selling them to local militants. And obviously now that's sort of turning around, and they're sort of thinking to the future. They don't have the it's like you say, Estonia didn't have the resources to build a digital state. The Russians, they want their great power status and their standing on the world stage. To do that, they need to have a adaptable army and an army capable of projecting force in all avenues of warfare, cyber, kinetic, political. They're just, I don't want to say they're the world's leader, because I couldn't tell you. I don't know if anyone could tell you that, but they are thinking that way. And I think the US is starting to cotton onto it quite a lot after Crimea, obviously, and the Donbass and stuff like that. But the US is probably the best at fifth generation warfare, I'd say. Like, look at the recent protests in Russia and Belarus. I could almost say for certain that the US probably has some sort of connection to it, and Ukraine as well. Most certainly, the European Union certainly does as well. I mean, Navalny's a whole interesting one for me. I don't know how much you know about Alexei Navalny, but he's not popular within Russia at all. I think your audio's gone.
Oh yeah, no, I was just saying, not at all. He's got a little cult following, but yeah, not the majority, I wouldn't say.
Well, in the West, we turn on the tap, and everything's Alexei Navalny's great, and
going to forget about him, right? If we were to make a forecast, we gave up on Juan Guaido, the Venezuelan, right? Remember the Trump administration? Oh. There was that.
Guaido? Yeah. I can't remember his name.
Do you remember when everyone was like, oh my God, they're going to... It was with Maduro, right?
Yeah, that sort of struck me as fifth generation warfare, as in you trying to politically change the country instead of just marching in there and having regime change as well.
Would you consider the Belt and Road Initiative sort of fifth generation warfare? And it's not even really warfare, but it's Venezuela, if you think about warfare in terms of trying to gain influence in another country, I feel like China's doing that just through economic development as opposed to troops on the ground. And they seem to be successful so far.
This links back to the classical geopolitics as well, because you look at heartland theory. I'm not sure how much you know about that. I think his name's Halford Mackinder. He went to my school, actually, funnily enough. He's old boy, sort of old school geography.
One of the fathers of geopolitics, right?
Yeah. I should have said that, should I? People know I went to school now. But yeah, heartland theory is like, if you control sort of Central Asia, Eastern Europe places, look at where China's moving into, the Belt and Road Initiative, Eastern Europe, Central Asia, Russia, then if you control the world island, you control the world.
Exactly.
So... what you're saying is in terms of hybrid or?
Yeah, just feel like the way that China's been getting influence is sort of in that fifth generation model, where it's less military focused and more gaining influence. More peaceably.
Anti-imperialist foreign policy, I think, is the word, or non-imperialist or something like that.
Unless you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh wait. Can't.
And I think we can talk about Taiwan.
The World Island's also interesting just from a U.S. perspective. Clay and I have talked, and I've told him that one of the things so troubling about the Trump administration for me was that it felt like we were sort of losing a lot of influence on the world stage. And as that was happening, Eurasia was sort of congealing and the World Island was coming together. And I think we're seeing that more with this China-Russia collaboration. The U.S. could be left on the sidelines of the next 50, 100 years of geopolitics.
I think after Brexit, kind of you'll always have us after Brexit, I think.
I think that's right.
Us Brits, but I'm just joking about it. Yeah, no, it's true. But then again, you look into history and you see before the Second World War, the sort of isolationism in America, no one really wanted to, I'm not sure about the First World War, but it's just obviously you have these historical trends, and I think they stem from geography. But the US is a isolated place when you think about it. I mean, probably less so now because Mexico and a lot of South American countries have sort of developed a bit more. And before, it was sort of the US and Canada, was it not? Just chilling over on in the, just there wasn't, they didn't have much of a connection.
Yeah.
Before, so, but now, so, again, sorry, carry on.
No. I was just going to say, normally towards the end of these podcasts, we like to do a few rapid fire questions and also predictions. You might not be a super forecaster, but you are not going to get out of this without making two different forecasts. But the first rapid fire question is something a little close to home, just talking about post Brexit. What are your thoughts on Canaz UK, the idea that Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and the UK makes this English-speaking sort of European Union-esque country to sort of stand out in the world stage, because alone they're kind of small?
That's an easy one. You've that's easy for me. I think it's a good idea. Maybe even include the US to some extent.
I mean, I would love, I mean, they're all just nice places to visit. I would,
one of my passions is sort of traveling, another cliche passion for you, but I've met so many European people, and I've met a lot of people from the Anglosphere, so to say, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and the US as well. I met a lot of Americans in there. I get on very well with them. I think it's probably the language aspect of it. We share the same humor. That's a big thing for me. I'm a big fan of humor, or the British sense of humor. So I get on really well with people from those countries, and we have a lot of legal, cultural, everything similarities. So I personally would love it. I mean, New Zealand looks amazing, so I'd love to go there. I'd be able to live and work there. Or I want to go to Australia as well, maybe work for a bit out there. So it, all the more if we can get together and come to some arrangement, I'll be perfectly happy. It's good for me, perfectly good for me. I'm not sure about the rest of the UK.
But we got at least one on board.
I think the UK as well, we're sort of the bridge for a lot of those places to Europe as well, because we are obviously in Europe, not in the European Union, but we're in Europe. We're close by, we're neighbors, we are a European country. But at the same time, we sort of look out to those countries, the US, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, as, I don't know, we have an affinity with Europe, and we have an affinity with those other countries. No matter if we're in the European Union or not, I love Germany. I love Latvia, it's one of my favorite countries. I absolutely love Lithuania. Poland's great as well. Can't say anything about France. British people can't speak about France.
Just can't hear it.
I think it's good to balance it for us. I think it's good. I want what's best for everyone. Cliche again.
All right. And then two forecasts. What is the likelihood that Putin annexes more territory in Eastern Europe in the next 5 years?
I can't see him touching the Baltics at all. Say it like it's nothing, but Belarus will be an interesting one. I mean, it's a very culturally similar place to Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm not sure what the situation with Lukashenko is at the moment, because obviously they're having they're going to have a constitutional referendum, which is obviously a lot of outlets were saying is driven by Russia, and basically maybe getting Lukashenko to stand down to sort of take the heat off the government, maybe. I don't know. So I don't know if Russia will sort of do a Ukrainian-style frozen conflict there. Doesn't seem likely, but I don't know. I can't say anything. Ukraine? Oh, that's another interesting one. I was listening to a talk the other day about frozen conflicts in the post-Soviet space. I think the guy that was given the talk said that the Russians might sort of create some movement in Ukraine to test the Biden administration. So that'll be quite interesting. Obviously, I think Biden has, I mean, there was that whole scandal, wasn't there, about Biden and Ukraine or whatever. I don't know. I don't know much about it, but he has some sort of link.
For Biden.
Yeah, he has some sort of links there. So it'll be. Yeah, no, we won't. We'll stop there. But yeah, obviously, you know, what I'm trying to say is obviously he has some links there. So it'll be a good place for Russia to sort of.
And also one of his first foreign policy actions was to publicize this additional Ukrainian arms sale. So then what percentage does this all work out to? You can't just say unlikely. We need a number that way.
Do you class Georgia, Azerbaijan, and Armenia as part of Europe as well? Or I'm not sure, but I don't think that. Well, anyway, I'd say 10% for it out there.
Okay.
You can cut the Biden part if you want as well.
No, everything stays. And then the second forecast is, what is the likelihood we credibly detect alien life, cellular proto-organisms in the next 10 years? And let's say one, just evidence that life used to exist, and then another one just for living and past life, say.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one as well. I'm quite interested in UFOs, but I mean, you can't see behind me, but I've got a big X-Files poster on the wall.
That's a classic.
I want to believe. I think they already know. I think the government, I think probably getting into conspiracy territory here, but I think governments probably have some sort of knowledge. I'd say, I mean, is it the Fermi paradox that says that the statistical probability of there not being life is greater, is less than the probability that there is life. So I'd say that maybe aliens have visited Earth already. This is probably not good for my channel views, but throw it out there anyway.
It is the internet. It is the internet.
Yeah. We're getting a bit Joe Rogan here, aren't we? But yeah.
I took DMT now.
Yeah. So I've got to come up with a percentage here, haven't I?
Yeah, so one for currently living life, and then one just for either living life or evidence of past life.
Being announced in the next 10 years.
Yep.
I mean, 100% certainty that there is both of those, but being announced, 50% I'm going to go for.
50% for both being announced or just historical?
Oh, previous.
Okay.
Historical. Maybe historical, bump it down to 20. But I reckon they'll announce that they've found alien life and probably in the next decade.
So we'll say 20% currently living life,
more files.
And 50% just any kind of alien life.
Yeah.
Okay. That's actually within the scope of our other guests as well.
Cool.
So we'll get back to you in 5 to 10 years.
Well done.
And, and we'll tell you how you did.
We can hopefully talk about it over a pint at one of London's.
Exactly.
Lovely pubs.
Fine establishments.
Or we'll go to a Spoon's.
So before we close out.
If it's about drinking, you can talk about it. I mean, go ahead.
Yeah. But before we close out, we wanted to, one, give you a chance just to once again plug, you know, your different channels and the stuff that you're working on. But also we just wanted to ask as we close out what you have planned for the future, what your and our viewers can look forward, you know, to coming from your channels in the near future.
That's a good one. Both linking with each other, what I was going to say anyway. So number one, more cooperation with you guys, hopefully. It'd be good to get more stuff, maybe even do a series together or something like that. I'd throw it out there, whatever.
Excellent.
I want to set up channel memberships on YouTube as well. And within that, the name I'm going with at the moment is the ARGS Intelligence Hub. So where I can't put out a video on everything at the moment, which I'd actually just ask, keep it to the future part of what I'm going to say. But yeah, just posting links to news stories, making my own sort of images, like I don't know how to describe it, not sort of magazine style images, but different maps and graphics, that's the word, graphics on stuff, and posting that in the community section and keeping people engaged in the channel itself, making it more than a YouTube channel is what I'd like to do. That came out pretty well. It sounded pretty good. Good advertising.
That sounded great. That's exciting.
I want to just make things a bit more interactive and maps. Obviously, I love maps. I did geopolitics. That's why I got into geopolitics. If you put a US map of the US in front of me right now, I could do every state for you, I reckon.
It's better than me. I can't do that, I don't think.
Yeah, it's better than probably a lot of Americans.
Yeah, don't actually do it. I probably could.
No worries there.
Yeah, putting stuff like that up, and eventually when I build to more subscribers. I want to enhance that as well. I should probably get my plan out there. I made a sort of plan of where I want to go. I want to get to the point where I can go to places like the Red Sea. I'd love to be able to go to the Red Sea and do some live reporting there, or head over to, I don't know, actually I'd like to say Central America. Chile is one I'd like to go to. So one video, let the competition know here, is the Mapuche conflict in Chile. I'm going to do a video on that. I don't know if you've heard of that before.
I haven't. That sounds really interesting. Clay and I are actually talking about potentially getting down to South America at some point too. So, you know, if all the trips line up, let's make it
happen.
Yeah,
yeah, we can do it. I want to do documentaries on stuff. So I'd like to go to places. Like, I don't know if you watched much of Vice News back in sort of the day.
The old Vice was really great.
Back in the peak Vice, yeah.
Yeah, sort of 2014 Russian roulette series was just, that's what got me into geopolitics and politics. Yeah, I think it was Simon Ostrov just going around Crimea and Ukraine, and just, it was just on the ground. That's where I want this channel to go. I want it to be, and I want it to be impartial as well. I don't think Vice News is very impartial as well. But yeah, that's where I want to go. I want to do everything pretty much. Like I say, that company that didn't give me the job, I just want to make them regret it.
Yeah, I think they already are. I think they already are.
I'm that kind of person. I don't take things lying down. Or if someone, well, they didn't wrong me, but if someone says I can't do something, prove them wrong, I'll go and do it. And I'll spend years of my life doing it. I'll dedicate myself, and I don't really care what people think. I don't like people give me stick on my videos. I'll address it in the comments section. If I'm wrong as well, if I'm wrong, I'll change my mind. That's a big thing. I don't think a lot of people do that. Nope. If there's new evidence, I'll change my mind. But yeah, I just want to expand things as much as possible. If cooperation with you guys is in that as well, like forecasting, we could intertwine our stuff. Maybe, I don't know. I mean, obviously, I think you guys, I look at your guys' stuff. I mean, that's really professional. I mean, some of my stuff, because I make it, there's only one of me and...
there's a bottleneck there.
It's not as polished. I really like the look of your website and everything in your podcast, and that's where I'd like to get my standard to, is just that sort of slick level. It's really cool,
because we actually love your videos and the way that you do all the graphics on that, especially the way in which you do Google Maps. I really like the B-roll footage. I think you pick some of the coolest shots. I think on the most recent one, when you had the fighter jets come in, I think I really like the way your videos look. So you guys can find Ross. His website is arglobalsecurity.com. On Twitter, it is at arglobalsec. And his TikTok is arglobalsecurity. All of those links and more will be down in the description below. Ross, thank you so much for taking your time today and speaking with us. We know it's very late over in the UK. That is Global Guessing Weekly Podcast, Episode 4. Thanks, everyone.
Just say to the audience, come over to my channel. You'll notice I reply to all of your comments as much as I can. Even on TikTok, I have 1,000 comments on some of my video. If people like my stuff, I'll go through liking every single comment, because I really do.
Subscribe, go follow, go support the AR Global Security community, and become part of the hub at some point when it launches.
Absolutely.
All right. And now that is the ending. All right. Thanks, everyone.
Lovely to speak to you guys. Thank you. Bye-bye.